From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the ceasefire ends in the Gaza conflict, leading the fight against the Islamic State militants. Latest on the Ebola outbreak, plus Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgents force victims to fight. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Palestinian authorities say a woman and a 2-year-old girl were killed by an Israeli missile in Gaza on Tuesday, the first deaths after a ceasefire ended early. The 24-hour truce officially expired at midnight local time Tuesday, but actually ended hours earlier when militant rockets from Gaza fell on southern Israel. Israel responded with airstrikes. A Hamas spokesman said the group did not fire rockets before the ceasefire expired. Backed by a series of U.S. airstrikes, Iraq's military took on Islamic State insurgents in the northern city of Tikrit on Tuesday. Western countries, including the United States, have also begun arming the Kurdish Peshmerga forces to aid their battle against the Sunni extremists. But there are concerns a heavily armed Kurdistan regional government might seek to declare independence and cause the breakup of the Iraqi state. Henry Ridgewell has our report.
On the outskirts of Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, traders display AK-47 assault rifles alongside other aging weapons and ammunition. Business is booming. After a decade of relative peace, the Kurds in northern Iraq believe their existence is threatened by the Islamic State militant group. Lukman Kader is among the hundreds of customers browsing the market. Just like other people, I have come here to buy a weapon to defend my family and my homeland, he says. But all the arms here are old and the ammunition is out of date. The Kurds' Soviet-era arsenal is being updated as several Western countries, including the United States and France, have begun arming the Kurdish Peshmerga forces. The Kurds have long dreamed of an independent homeland, and the arrival of advanced Western arms could have unintended consequences, says Afzal Ashraf of the Royal United Services Institute in London.
The Kurdish homeland straddles what is Iraq, what is bits of Iran and Syria and Turkey. And if there are nationalists in the Kurdish regional government who want to pursue that agenda with those additional arms, with the additional experience, they could pose a threat to stability in that region.
This week, Kurdish forces, backed by the Iraqi army and aided by U.S. airstrikes, seized control of the strategic Mosul Dam from Sunni militants. The battle against the Islamic State, or ISIS militants, is uniting rival Kurdish factions, says Zeynep Kaya of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics.
ISIS is bringing the Kurds in Syria and the Kurds in Iraq together, even though KDP and PYD were not on good terms until recently. Now the PYD forces and PKK forces also are helping Peshmerga.
PKK militants fought a decades-long war for autonomy against the Turkish state. Peace talks are ongoing. The Kurdistan regional government in Iraq would be reluctant to upset Ankara by stirring Kurdish nationalism, says Kaya.
KRG's oil export depends on Turkey. So the more KRG is increasing its power in the region and within Iraq, the more sort of it's becoming dependent on Turkey.
The oil wealth has caused friction with Iraq's central government. Economic independence from Baghdad is a key demand of the Kurds, says representative of the Kurdistan Regional Government in London, Bayan Sami Abdul Rahman.
They have tried to centralize control of the oil and gas sector. We have, of course, gone against that. Where Baghdad has failed to control us, they have punished. How have they punished? Since January, we haven't had our budget, our normal budget. It's a ridiculous situation that today Kurdistan is fighting the most well-armed and rich terrorist organization in the world, and yet we haven't had our budget from Baghdad.
If Iraq is to survive as a state, there will have to be big changes, says Abdul Rahman.
Even after ISIS are pushed out, defeated, and we go back to, let's say, business as usual, it won't be business as usual. The fact is that Iraq has to be regionalized if it's going to stay together.
The future of Kurdistan will have to wait. The Kurds, the Iraqi army and the West are united in battle against the Islamic State militants. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
United Nations said Tuesday it's launching a major aid response in Iraq, sending in material by air as well as land and sea to help tens of thousands of refugees fleeing the Islamic State militants. Estimated 1.2 million Iraqis have been displaced so far this year. UN says the operation will start with a four-day airlift from neighboring Jordan into the city of Erbil. United States, Britain, Germany, and France are taking part in the humanitarian effort. International Coalition of Activists is calling on the UN Human Rights Council to convene an emergency session on the plight of minorities in Iraq, including the Yazidis and Christians. The executive director of the monitoring group UN Watch, Hillel Neuer, says the activists are appealing to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, to call for the special session.
Second, to establish a fact-finding mission to investigate the Islamic States for their acts that destroy in whole or in part ethnic and religious groups that may constitute genocide, as defined in the Genocide Convention. And finally, to revive the mandate, which used to exist here in Geneva, of a special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Iraq. It was terminated 10 years ago. We're asking for it to be revived to ensure that we have an early warning mechanism for the international community with regular reporting to both the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly.
Leader of the Yazidi people, the son of the leader, Breen Tahsin, said he's calling on the UN Human Rights Council to meet urgently on the destruction of minorities in Iraq. He said Islamist militants have killed more than 3,000 Yazidi men and kidnapped about 5,000 people, most of them women and children, during their offensive in Iraq. Tahsin is calling on the UN and the international community to help resettle Yazidis to Europe, to America, Canada, and Australia. He says the people can no longer live in Iraq where they are in danger of being exterminated.
Until that, establish a safe region under directing and protection of United Nations for Yazidi and Christian of Iraq who plan to continue living in Iraq, because it's no saving until any time from now.
Member of the community of Iraqi Christians, Mariam Wahida, describes the conditions under which tens of thousands of displaced Christians are living in Kurdistan. She says they need shelter, they need food and medicine. She also says the Christian population has been decimated and there is no future for them in Iraq. U.S. Federal Aviation Administration this week issued a notice to airmen restricting the U.S. air carriers from flying over Syria, citing what it calls the ongoing armed conflict and volatile security environment that poses a serious potential threat to civil aviation. It notes that armed extremist groups in Syria are known to have been equipped with a variety of anti-aircraft weapons, which have the capability to threaten civilian aircraft. Earlier this month, the FAA restricted U.S. carriers from flying over Iraq. Scott Hamilton of the Washington State-based aviation consultancy Liam Company told VOA's Victor Beatty he's surprised the FAA didn't act sooner, given the July downing of a Malaysian Airlines plane over eastern Ukraine by a surface-to-air missile.
The fact that you had an airplane that was flying at 33,000 feet and it got shot down, suddenly they wake up and say there's a problem when you fly over a war zone, it's just mind-boggling.
I guess what's happening on the ground has forced the FAA to become, what would you say, more sensitive to what's going on the ground around the world?
I think that's a fair conclusion, and the FAA, unfortunately, has been known for decades as a tombstone agency. They don't take action until somebody dies. And as tragic as MH17 was concerned, that's the Malaysian flight that went down over the Ukraine after being shot down. But where in the world has the FAA been? This is just another example of tombstone mentality. And I think, as much as I hate to say it, because Congress always overreacts to stuff anyway, that somebody ought to be asking some tough questions of the FAA.
What impact will this have on transcontinental flights?
What the effect is it will mean longer routings, more cost in terms of fuel, wear and tear on the airplanes. But flying around hostile areas is not at all uncommon. You know, U.S. Airlines have been flying around the Korean Peninsula since the Korean War. To this day, you can't overfly North Korea. So anything going from Tokyo to China, for example, has to fly around the Korean Peninsula or certainly around the North Korean airspace. So this is not new.
Todd Curtis, founder of the Seattle-based website airsafe.com, says many carriers long ago came to the conclusion Syrian airspace was too dangerous.
Recently, I looked at one of the many commercial applications that are out there, a website that tracks commercial activity all over the world. And it's interesting that on this morning, August 19th, there was actually no commercial airliners of any kind flying over Syrian airspace. And surprisingly, there were quite a few over northern Iraq, but none over Syria. So this has been something that the FAA didn't have to come out with a change of ruling. I believe other countries, and more specifically other airlines, have seen fit to avoid that area while that situation sorts itself out.
There's an organization in Switzerland called the Small Arms Survey. They came out with a report recently indicating armed groups in Syria have an estimated several hundred portable anti-aircraft missiles that can easily be diverted to extremists and used to destroy low-flying commercial planes. Is it becoming increasingly dangerous to fly the world's skies today?
Well, it's increasingly dangerous for that reason that was mentioned, not just in Syria or in that region, but small shoulder-fired missiles are common throughout the world in conflict zones. Now, the bad thing about those missiles is that they can cause serious damage to large commercial airliners and may even shoot them down. One limitation that these systems have is that they typically can only be effective up to about 10 to 15,000 feet. When aircraft are flying at cruising altitudes, typically in the 30,000 to 40,000 foot range, those kinds of missiles won't be a hazard. But as MH17 has showed, if you have a new system introduced into an area, a system that has the capability to reach into the stratosphere, and if airlines are not aware of it, they could unwittingly fly into areas where they could be reached by these missiles. And it's unclear whether that sort of situation is happening right now in Syria.
Curtis says today's environment is making it more challenging for governments and carriers to determine which airspace needs to be avoided. He says there are only a handful of countries, especially the United States, with the capability of cataloging the threats that exist. He says the challenge is devising a way to quickly transfer that information to global civil aviation organizations without compromising the sources or methods that keep civilian aviation safe.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
In Liberia, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has announced a new nighttime curfew in the West Point neighborhood of the capital, Monrovia. This follows last weekend's ransacking of an Ebola isolation center by looters. In the chaos, 17 Ebola patients escaped the center but have now been accounted for. Liberia also under a state of emergency for 90 days to try to contain the Ebola outbreak, which has killed more than 460 people there. The government in Monrovia also says three patients are improving after having been given the experimental drug ZMapp. World Health Organization says the Ebola epidemic is far from over, but it sees more encouraging signs in Nigeria and Guinea. The UN agency says 2,240 cases, including 1,229 deaths, have been reported from Liberia, Guinea, Nigeria, and Sierra Leone. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says the Ebola outbreak continues to grow. It reported more than 100 new cases of Ebola across West Africa on Tuesday. But the UN Health Agency says some reassuring signs can be seen in Nigeria. A patient brought Ebola into the country last month when he flew into Lagos from heavily affected Liberia. He subsequently infected several people with the deadly disease. But WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib tells VOA The city's 12 confirmed cases of Ebola and 4 deaths are all part of a single chain of transmission, which he says is encouraging.
The situation seemed quite good in Nigeria, and this is also a sign that the health authorities in Nigeria have taken all the right measures to detect, follow and trace all the contact of this man, and also to do a very comprehensive surveillance to detect any other Ebola cases.
Shaib says Nigeria will have to pass through 2 incubation periods of 21 days each. And if no cases of the disease are confirmed for 42 days, the country will be declared free of this dreaded disease.
We are not yet there. We miss some 10 days in Nigeria in order to make this statement.
Unlike Nigeria, the Ebola outbreak is continuing to rage in Guinea, where the disease has killed 394 people. But the agency says the outbreak in Guinea is more under control than it is in Liberia and Sierra Leone. Shaib says public awareness of the facts about Ebola is higher there than in the other affected countries. As a consequence, preventive measures are being taken.
There is more surveillance, more case detection, but in another way also. For example, we know for Guinea, many villages were really very reticent and resistant to cooperate with health workers. But with the help of the community health leaders, several villages were open to the international health workers, and they were able to work with the villages and to find the contact, to isolate people who are sick.
The World Health Organization reports the opening of 26 villages that previously were resistant has resulted in a surge of reported cases. The agency notes these cases previously were concealed and are not interpreted as a sudden upsurge in Guinea's outbreak. It says the outbreak is not under control in Guinea and a flare-up of the disease could occur at any time. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Dr. David DeBarro, the senior UN coordinator on the Ebola virus, will be traveling to Africa later this week. He says the UN's first priority is to stop the spread of the virus, which he says has changed the way society as a whole interacts. Dr. DeBarro emphasized the importance of preparing for the next outbreak of a deadly virus. Well, while Nigerian authorities focus on containing the Ebola outbreak, the Boko Haram insurgency continues to expand in size and tactics as it kidnaps villagers and forces them to fight. Heather Murdoch has more from Abuja.
In northern Nigeria, kidnapping is becoming more common as Boko Haram militants storm villages, taking men, women, and children. Last week, nearly 100 victims were reportedly rescued from insurgents, but no one knows how many are still being held. The victims, says James Woye, a pastor who counsels kidnap victims in northern Nigeria, are often forced to join Boko Haram, blurring the line between the attackers and those they attack.
These young people out there in the forest, without hope now, their hope only is to die. And we should save them. I think we should pity everybody on each side, because if this violence is affecting both the perceived aggressor and the victim.
Kidnap victims are strengthening Boko Haram by growing their army, says Yan St-Pierre, the CEO of the Berlin-based security consulting firm Mosicon. Where once the group was just trying to survive, he says it is now trying to take over territories.
Boko Haram is now planning strategically long-term. It's not about replenishing forces, it's about acquiring more personnel.
Boko Haram has killed thousands of people this year alone in a growing 5-year-old insurgency. Constantly morphing, the group says it wants to enforce a harsh version of Islamic law and is increasingly well-armed and well-funded. St-Pierre says Boko Haram has begun using tactics pioneered by Joseph Kony in Uganda and Charles Taylor in Sierra Leone to gain loyalty from victims. He says kidnap victims, including children, are sometimes forced to kill people they know or love.
By making them kill their own parents or their own family, it makes them be in a position where they can't go back. Psychologically, they're absolutely broken. They killed their parents. They literally murdered what brought them to life. In that sense, their loyalty becomes to the only family that they have now, which is the army or the terrorist group that kidnapped them.
He says Boko Haram also kidnaps girls and women, including the more than 200 schoolgirls abducted 4 months ago to use as household help, sex slaves, and most recently, bombers. Last month, at least 9 people were killed in 4 attacks by female suicide bombers. 2 other girls were arrested, one, a 10-year-old, strapped with a bomb.
They're taking these little girls now and using them as weapons. So it's a double use by kidnapping girls.
In Borno and Adamawa states, 2 of the 3 Nigerian states that have been under emergency rule for more than a year, locals report that Boko Haram has taken over villages and towns, killing anyone that objects. Analysts say the strategy appears to be to create a circle of power around the Borno state government in the city of Maiduguri, with the goal of taking the state capital. The Nigerian military has previously said it has not and will not allow Boko Haram to rule any parts of Nigeria. This is Defense Spokesman Major General Chris Olukolade.
The Nigerian military will not concede any portion of this country to terrorists or any such group.
However, a Boko Haram takeover may not be what it sounds like. If villagers are terrified into pledging loyalty to Boko Haram, the group can essentially control the area without hanging flags or building walls. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
UN Refugee Agency reports Ethiopia now hosts more refugees than any other country in Africa. By the end of last month, Ethiopia was sheltering almost 630,000 registered refugees. UNHCR spokesperson Adrian Edwards says that bad weather has complicated the situation for 18,000 refugees who are living in 3 temporary sites in the western region of Ethiopia known as Gambela.
In recent weeks, heavy rain has, however, flooded 3 of the low-lying sites in this area, as well as Lake Shore Camp, where the situation is most serious. Some 10,000 refugees, more than a fifth of Lake Shore's population of 47,500, have been hit by flooding. Many tents and shelters are underwater, and latrines have collapsed.
Edwards tells VOA the flooding is causing health concerns. He says the heavy rains are threatening to undermine gains made in preventing the outbreak of waterborne diseases.
Much of the refugee population arriving in neighboring countries has been children throughout this crisis. They have particular vulnerabilities. We have stepped up measures to contain hepatitis E among South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia. The disease has spread across South Sudan over the last 2 years, and it has now appeared in the border camps in Ethiopia.
Edwards says 12 refugees have died from hepatitis E since April. Hepatitis E, a viral disease that causes liver failure, is spread by fecal contamination of water supplies or food. He says the UNHCR is working with the Ethiopian government, the WHO, and other partners to try to contain the disease.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Also in the news, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko is set to attend a meeting next week, also to be attended by Russian President Vladimir Putin. They will be addressing the crisis in eastern Ukraine. Tuesday's announcement comes as Ukrainian troops pressed attacks on 2 key eastern cities under rebel control in Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine. Violence against aid workers hit a record high last year, according to research released on Tuesday. London-based consultancy group Humanitarian Outcomes says worldwide 155 aid workers were killed, 171 seriously wounded, and 134 were kidnapped in 2013. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. You know, if you find yourself on the internet at voanews.com, you can download a podcast of this very program, International Edition, or any of our other programs. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On August 20th, 1794, a force led by U.S. General Anthony Wayne defeated an Indian confederation in the Battle of Fallen Timbers. The victory led to a peace treaty that encouraged the western expansion of the United States. In 1910, Finnish-born American architect Eero Saarinen was born. Saarinen is best known for his design of the Gateway Arch in St. Louis, Missouri, the TWA Terminal Building at JFK International Airport in New York, and the Terminal Building at Washington's Dulles International Airport. In 1920, the Detroit News newspaper put radio station 8MK on the air. The station claimed to be the first radio station to broadcast regularly scheduled programs. Today, it is news and sports station WWJ. Also in 1920, seven men, including legendary football player Jim Thorpe, met in Canton, Ohio to organize a professional football league. The meeting led to the creation of the American Professional Football Conference, the forerunner to the current National Football League. In 1940, Marxist theorist Leon Trotsky, one of the leaders of the Russian Revolution, was killed by a Soviet agent at his house in Mexico. Just before midnight on this day in 1968, Warsaw Pact forces invaded Czechoslovakia, occupying the country the next day and ending the country's brief flirtation with democratization known as the Prague Spring. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Simply put, without the ocean, there is no life on Earth. At the most basic level, the ocean produces 50 to 70% of our oxygen. It regulates our climate, absorbs carbon dioxide, and supports the greatest abundance of life on our planet. Today, some 12% of the global population makes its livelihood from the sea. And therein lies the problem. We humans are killing the ocean. As fishermen endeavor to supply the demand for seafood, they take too many fish, particularly the more popular species. Today, an estimated 29% of the world's fish stocks are overexploited, while another 61% cannot support expanded harvest and require effective management to avoid decline. Some stocks of tuna, swordfish, halibut, cod, and flounder populations have been devastated by overfishing. The ocean is threatened today as never before, said Secretary of State John Kerry. It is threatened by overpollution. It is threatened by climate change, which is having a profound impact on acidity of the ocean, which has an impact on all of the ecosystem, and it is profoundly affected by overfishing. There is too much money chasing too few fish, and most of the major fisheries of the world are either in extremis or near extremis. The Obama administration is particularly committed to improving the health of our ocean and is considering ways to expand protections for vast expanses of the Pacific Ocean, where the United States has jurisdiction. At Secretary Kerry's Our Ocean Conference in Washington this past June, participants from around the globe announced new commitments on the protection of more than 3 million square kilometers of the ocean and dedicated more than $800 million to conserve the ocean and its resources. We are committed to addressing the threats to the health of the oceans posed by climate change, as we have reduced our greenhouse gas emissions through strong action in the U.S., putting us on the path to meeting the U.S. goal of reducing emissions in range of 17% below 2005 levels by 2020, said Secretary Kerry. Our hope is that in the next few years, there will be a new consciousness created about the responsibility to the ocean and the extraordinary connection of the ocean to everything we do and need to do on Earth itself.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.